And good morning and welcome to this July 27th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. We are also on Twitter at KUCI FM. We're on Instagram. We are everywhere. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors, not only about their books, but about writing process, creativity, craft, all those things that go into creating compelling fiction. This morning is full of fun and inspiration. I'm here now with Molly Antipole. We're going to be talking about short stories. And in the second half, Brad Watson is on to talk about his latest novel, Miss Jane, but first Molly. Molly was on the show with my co-host Nicole Nelson in, I think, February of 2014. For a full podcast of that interview, you can check out our website. But something about this current election season and people throwing themselves, regardless of side, into their candidates and all these things, divisiveness, caused me to pick up that collection. Again, I had fallen in love with it when it first came out, and it seems oh so relevant today for a lot of reasons, and I want to talk to her some more. So, you know, I just think literature is often a salve to a lot of stuff and a way to make sense of a world that often doesn't make sense, and this feels like the right collection for the right time. So it's my pleasure to continue the conversation Nicole started 2 years ago with Molly. Molly's debut short story collection, The Un-Americans, won the New York Public Library's Young Lions Fiction Award, the French American Prize, and was a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree. The book was longlisted for the National Book Award and was a finalist for the Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize, the Barnes & Noble Discover Award, the National Jewish Book Award, the California Book Award, on and on. The book appeared on a dozen Best of 2014 lists and is published in 7 countries. She's the recipient of fellowships from the Radcliffe Institute, the American Academy in Berlin, and Stanford, where she teaches creative writing. She's at work on a novel, which I cannot wait for. Molly, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
What an introduction. Good grief. And I hope I didn't overly freak you out with my introduction, make the you feel like you're going to be about to be drawn into some political discussion, because that's really not my intent. But I do think there are some generalities of the human condition or human psychology or sociology that I think this collection really sheds some gorgeous light on. So I think we can talk in real generalities. But why don't we start by having you introduce the collection again to kind of set the stage and what you were thinking about and where these stories came from.
Sure. So the collection, The Un-Americans, it's the stories move from McCarthy era Los Angeles to communist Prague to contemporary Israel and back again. And I should say that I really had no idea what the thematic thread or the political thread or any of that would be when I was writing the stories. I was just so focused on trying to make each story work as well as it could on its own. And it was only when most of the collection was done that I kind of looked at all of the stories and was trying to figure out, you know, what the overarching theme was, because I thought, wow, they're not threaded together by place or by character or by voice, as so many of the collections that I really love are, that I found that instead they were really kind of linked together by this theme. And the theme was, what happens if the causes that you've dedicated your life to lose relevance in the course of world events, and where do you go from there? Right. And so that's basically what the collection is about.
Yeah, and I do think that there are so many resonance today with a lot of people, I mean, throughout history, but today too, with a lot of people who are throwing themselves into things that may not be relevant, throwing themselves into ideas that, you know, 10, 20, 25 years from now may not be relevant. And so I just feel like, as I said before, this is the right collection at the right time. And as I was reading these stories, which are all so specific, they yet felt so universal and I love that. Isn't that what great fiction does? So,
well, thank you so much. So,
really great. Really great. And I love to talk to you a little bit, and we can take whatever story you wish, but whatever your act of creating these, because I know each story took about a year, maybe even more than a year to write. And I thought it would be kind of an interesting exercise, because I'm such a lover of short fiction, to sort of start with one story, your original kernel, whatever the tiniest spark was that ignited the story, and and kind of what sustained it, and then how it changed over time, over the course of that year, into what it became and how it kind of bloomed. And, you know, kind of through that process of discovery to birth of a story, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. I've never done this. It's a great thing to think about, you know, because all of these stories, I don't think any of them took less than a year and a half to write. And that was, you know, me working pretty diligently about 6 days a week on, you know, on those stories. And all of them changed so drastically draft by draft. And I actually think that with all of them, they all seem to start with some kind of image for me that I can't shake. I'll be on a walk with my dog, or I'll be on a run, and some image will just come into my mind, and I don't know what it is, but I know that I need to write toward it. And so, you know, I'll have an image. I remember once I had an image of like a girl, you know, jumping off a rock into an ocean, and I thought, wow, this image was just in my mind. So I tried to write toward this image, and of course, by the time I got done, you know, even with the first draft, there was no rock, there was no girl, there was no ocean. But I suddenly had the beginning of a story. So I have these strange jumping off points that I don't think
literally ever
actually make it into the story. So I'm trying to think of, all of these stories, again, like so many revisions and so much drastic rewriting. The last story that I worked on was the last story in the collection, Retrospective. Mm. And so in a lot of ways, that's the one that still feels the most alive to me, just because I was working on it the most recently. And that was an interesting one because I had gotten really interested in the unofficial art movement in Russia, and I was reading all of this nonfiction about it. There's this incredible John McPhee book called The Ransom of Russian Art, and I was just so, so excited about this topic. And that's also another way that a lot of times the stories happen for me, is that I love to read nonfiction. I love to watch documentaries. I love the research part of it, and I just sort of would be doing that kind of research anyway, and then the characters and the situations kind of emerge sometimes from that research. So with that story, which is It's a little complicated to explain, but it's about a young Israeli guy whose wife has left him for another man. She's pregnant, and he is completely distraught and also very much in love with her family as much as he is with her. And so when her kind of wealthy, fabulous art-collecting grandmother from Jerusalem dies, he decides to go to Israel to be the one to deal with her estate as a way to kind of cling and, you know, and still be a part of the family. And so I started just with a strange image and with a big interest in this unofficial Russian art that the grandmother was collecting. And I was working on this story. And it was really, really hard for me. I knew that I was invested in the characters. I knew I was invested in the situation. But I just felt like I was just struggling with it. And in an early draft, actually I think for about maybe the first five drafts, the narrator was a woman, and so it was a pregnant woman whose husband had left her for another woman, and so it was sort of like the situation was reversed. And I just remember feeling so stuck with the story and so kind of mad at myself that it was taking me so long. And then I realized that part of it for me was that the scenario of a husband leaving a woman was something that I had read so often in fiction. And I also feel like the idea of leaving a pregnant woman, it completely, like, there's only one way that the reader will basically feel about that, which felt less interesting to me and less morally complicated. Yeah. And so when I switched the gender dynamics and suddenly it was a privileged woman who was pregnant, who felt completely confident in her situation and in her life, to basically be on her own in that situation, that felt so much fresher to me and more interesting to explore. And so somehow doing that gender switch was the way that I could really get into the story.
It's interesting that you say that, because another story in this collection is reminding me of that, which is, I'll get the title wrong, but it's something about a story that my grandmother told me, I think is the title.
Right. And that also had a huge switch in revision.
Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about that, because that's another case of woman playing against type in a really interesting, really unexpected way that I thought worked so well.
Oh, I'm glad. I mean, that was also, I have to say, you know, I've heard older writers say every writer gets this one gift where the story arrives fully formed in your mind, and all you feel like you're doing is just like, you know, doing transcription. And that has never happened to me in my entire life. Like every one of these stories, there was so much sweat and shame and despair and like all of that as I was writing it, just feeling like I couldn't get these stories done. And my grandmother tells me the story was a really hard one. That's a story about a young teenage partisan fighter, during World War II. And that story, I had gotten really interested in a lot of my research of my own family history from this village of Antipol, which is my last name and where my family's from. And I got really, really interested in in these kind of guerrilla camps of teenagers that where they were partisan fighters in the forest surrounding Antipol. And I was so interested in that research, and was traveling to these places, was interviewing people. I was in the archives. I basically just got complete research rapture. And so in an earlier draft, that story was written in kind of a distant third person, and it just felt like historical fiction. Like, it felt dusty and mechanical and all the things that I don't like about, quote-unquote historical fiction, where you can feel the author's hand, you can feel the research. And I thought, okay, you know what? I'm really interested in the story. I'm so passionate about the topic, but I don't know how to tell the story, and I think the story just doesn't get to be in the book. And I put it away. I put it in a drawer along with, many other orphan stories that I hope no one will ever see. And about a year and a half later, after I'd abandoned the story, I remember I was swimming in a lake in upstate New York. I was about as far from the research in Eastern Europe that I'd been doing as I could possibly be. And I was working on another story, and I was swimming in this lake, and I was upset. I was just thinking, like, why am I so obsessed with these dark periods of history that I never lived through? Like, why, when, my grandparents had such a rough go of things, my mother had a rough go of things, and, like, in every generation things seem to get easier, why am I so focused on these parts of history that so much of my family doesn't even want to talk about? They don't want to look at it, so why do I want to look at it? And the moment that I kind of confronted that question for myself, I realized that was really the central tension in that story. My grandmother tells me the story. And so sitting in that, like swimming in that lake in upstate New York, I said, okay, Molly, you can't leave the lake. Like, it was getting cold. And I said, I can't leave that lake until I can figure out the first line of the story. And I did. And then I thought, okay, don't leave the lake until you figure out the first paragraph. And I just stayed in that lake and kind of figured out this grandmother's voice. And the fact that it would be a direct address to her granddaughter. And the moment that I figured out that voice, it was basically, I could basically throw away about 98% of the research that I had done for the story, because I understood who her audience was, and I understood all of the parts of history, both political and familial, that the granddaughter would already know. And so I suddenly knew how to tell that story. And then within telling that story and understanding, and understanding sort of like the central tension and the central relationship in the story, I was also able to think a lot more, as you said, about the gender dynamics in the story. And it was so interesting for me to think about what it was like for this young girl. She's 12 in the story, who is basically forced to act like an adult when in so many ways she still is such a child. And what does that do to someone psychologically, and how does that affect the rest of her life? And so once I was able to kind of hit that central question, then I could really explore it from there.
Dang, there's like 8 things that came out of that I want to talk to you about. That's incredible.
And I want to say one other thing, which is that I was really fortunate. I had been on this. It's a program in Lithuania, a writing program. And while I was there, I was revising this story, and I happened to meet a woman who was an expert on the psychology of teenage partisan fighters. And so I basically just kind of grabbed her in the corner and asked her a million questions, and that was incredibly useful also to kind of get away from some of the archival research and some of the books and actually just talk to a person. And that to me was just, that also really cracked open the story.
You often wonder, I think, as a writer, if things just get called into your life, like you're a big giant, magnet for something, that just stuff from the universe gets pulled into you and it tells you, you were meant to write this. This is the story you were put on this earth to do. And your Lithuanian woman story is kind of reminding me of that.
I know.
You're just like calling her into your life.
I think that's true. I think I remember, an older writer came to visit, not older, but, a more seasoned writer came to visit one of my classes one day. And he said something that really, really stuck with me. He said that my students were all so lucky. They're undergrads and they were in their first writing class. And he said, you guys are all so lucky, because I think that everyone has probably 3 stories that are already inside them that they really need to tell. And right now, you're taking writing classes to try to figure out how to tell them. And he said, the scarier thing as you get older is that you've already told the stories that you need to put out in the world. And then suddenly you have the skills, but you're fumbling around for new stories.
Yeah.
And I really did feel that way with this first book. Like, all of these stories felt so urgent, and they felt like these things that I absolutely had to tell, and the challenge was just figuring out how to, all of the craft skills to be able to write them.
Right. So did you ever get an answer to yourself to the question of why you feel so drawn to this as you write about it over and over when your family is not drawn to it? Obviously, there's something that calls you to it. Is there ever an answer to that? Or do you think that's just, you know, what, I don't know, what fuels your writerly imagination and there's kind of no reason for it?
I mean, I think it's the latter. My mom says, you know, when I was young, it was me and my mom, and so I spent, you know, I definitely was a kid who spent a lot of time alone and lived in my head. And she said that she would just find me in the corner, oftentimes, just poring over her yearbooks, like poring over her high school yearbooks and coming up with these stories about all of these people in the yearbooks. And you know, and the same thing where, you know, every time I loved a book, I would sit down and try to write myself into the book, and suddenly, you know, my favorite character from a book would have a sister named Molly who'd go on all these adventures. And so I think there was this feeling of just getting really lost in books. And in the same way, it was this feeling ever since I was little, like ever since I can remember, of just getting really, really lost in these family stories. And especially, you know, and those Antipal stories that I didn't really know very much about, they almost felt kind of mythical because people didn't want to talk about them.
Right.
And so I think it was, and I think that it might just sort of be, you know, every writer in the family has those traits.
I think that's right. I think that's right. My guest this morning is Molly Antipole, the debut story collection that was out a couple of years ago, but is still as wonderful, great, and relevant as ever, is called The Un-Americans. And I want to talk a little bit about, I think one pitfall for new writers or maybe even old writers is being brave enough and the act of bravery in writing and going deep enough and when you know you've gone deep enough and how scared... Mm-hmm. We get of some emotional terrain, and maybe we don't even know that we haven't gone deep enough. We think we've gone fairly far, but we haven't even started. And I was wondering if over time with these stories, because these do feel like massive acts of bravery and there's so much scary stuff. And did you know that you were, I don't know if this question makes sense, but did you know you were getting deep enough, going, you know, scary enough to make them so emotionally fulfilling? Because they're obviously striking such a chord with people.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. That is so nice to hear. That was something that I thought so much about when I was writing. When I was an undergraduate and I was, you know, first starting to write stories, and actually that was probably the first time that I started trying to understand stories as a writer rather than a reader, I think the thing that I was the most afraid of was seeming sentimental or being sappy. And I don't know why, but those just felt, I mean, probably it's also just being that age where it just felt like the absolute, like, most shameful, vulnerable, humiliated things to be would be to show all the sides, just basically to, like, reveal my brain to readers felt so scary to me. And so I was writing these really kind of cool, tightly controlled stories that, looking back on them, I mean, they were really bloodless, you know, and they were really, they lacked a lot of emotion because I was so afraid. And I remember, I can remember it exactly. There were two writers, and I read them the same, you know, the same year, Grace Paley and James Baldwin. And they both just completely cracked open and changed the way that I thought about writing, because I thought, here are two people who are so compassionate toward everyone they write about. Here are two people who are so emotionally generous and so unafraid of emotion. And in fact, they seem to be writing toward they're not at all interested in trying to charm or impress the reader with their cleverness. Instead, I feel like they're writing directly and very fearlessly about the things that matter the most to them. And that was so thrilling to me and so inspiring to me that I thought, okay, this is what I need to do. And those really are the two writers who helped me do that. And I feel like they're forever going to sit on my shoulders because of that. Because I thought, what's the point? I mean, you know, writing is a really lonely act. It's incredibly humbling. So much rejection comes with it. There's so much self-doubt. There are so many other things that I could be doing during the day that might be more enjoyable. And so if I'm really going to sit here and I'm going to devote myself to this thing, I have to do it because it really matters to me, and because these are the stories that I deeply have to tell. And once I realized that, what I found is that I started the writers that I found myself connecting to over the years. Joy Williams, Sergei Dovlatov, Jim Shepard, all these writers that I just sort of fell in love with. I just felt the urgency of what they were trying to say, and I found that they were able to write about the most painful and scariest parts of life, and they were basically able to turn these things that otherwise might feel like they could take over my life, they were able to turn them into a story, and they were able to create a narrative and a structure around these things that are so scary in life and turn them into art. And I thought, okay, that's the goal.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was just listening to a lecture by Steve Almond on this very topic a couple of weeks ago. And his point was, because people in the audience were saying, I'm afraid of sounding like the 13-year-old girl's diary. And that's right. Every writer's fear, I think. And he said, you know, the goal is to make people feel not tell them what you feel, not tell them I was sad and I cried, but to make them cry themselves. And I think that's the difference, is to bring a story alive by making your reader feel what you feel instead of telling them how you feel, which I guess
is that's really smart. He does that really well. You know, his collection, My Life in Heavy Metal, was really important to me. That's one of those books that's completely marked up and, you know, with many different colored pens as I tried to figure out the structure of his stories. And it's exactly it. It's just, it's that feeling as a reader of completely connecting with someone else's work and basically getting the experience to, like, live within their mind and their set of obsessions and to feel the things that, and for the things that they feel so deeply to have some meaning for us is basically, I think, why most of us read.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the other things writers struggle with is backstory. And I hear a lot or see a lot of short fiction that is really overwhelmed by the backstory. There's such a reliance of, well, I have to tell you this thing that happened before I can tell you the front story. And these feel so well balanced. And I was wondering if that was ever a problem for you and how you kind of overcame, you know, staying in the forward momentum of the story, but yet informing it a little bit, but not too much with backstory.
Oh, I mean, that was such a struggle. I mean, basically every part of writing is difficult in its own way, but that was such a struggle, I think, because so many of the writers that I admire the most and the writers that I sort of look to as models didn't use a lot of backstory. I admire so many writers, you know, where it's these, you know, kind of spare single-scene stories where they just are constantly moving forward. And so that was another thing that I tried to do forever, and I just finally had to accept the fact that I really love backstory and that I kind of love that moment when there's a space break in a story. You know, we have a scene and then there's a space break and then suddenly now we get to hear like all the dirt on the characters and we get to know, okay, this is what they were saying and seeing, but this is really how they're feeling and this is really what's going on in their marriage and with their kids and this is who they used to date and this is da 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 da. All of that stuff I find like it's exciting for me. It feels kind of like, okay, I'm getting like the real story on these people. And so once I realized that I loved that, I just looked to writers who used a lot of backstory and who I thought used it really well. So, you know, Alice Munro was a huge model for me. Edward P. Jones, both collections, but especially his second one. You know, Deborah Eisenberg. And, you know, with these writers, it's also writing longer stories and just sort of allowing them to feel like these full worlds. And so I basically just kind of had, Edith Perlman's another one, where I just kind of had to find these writers who could serve as models for how to do that and how to make the backstory feel as complicated and as fraught as the real time, so that what the backstory ends up doing is, you know, complicating and informing whatever's happening in real time.
I love it. And I love your commitment to the short story form, because you hear so much people saying, you know, why don't you make this a novel, or novels are you know, the short story is the ugly stepchild. I mean, I'm so committed to the short story form myself, both in reading and writing. I just think it's the perfect gem of the way to look
too.
Into people's hearts.
I do, too, and they're so hard. I mean, it's probably my least favorite comment that I've ever gotten is when someone thinks they're paying me a compliment and they say, wow, I really love that story. It could be a novel. And I'm like, oh, really? Like, is it like, oh, I really love that sandwich. It could be, like, a glass of juice. Like, it's just these completely different things. And I feel like there's something really patronizing in those comments, because it's basically saying, like, okay, stories are what young writers, you know, do to get their sea legs before they can embark on the big, bad novel. And I just don't feel like that's true at all.
I don't either. I mean, I really feel like they're hard. You know, in the way that poetry to write is very hard. To compress something down that much and to make people feel the full spectrum of human emotions is very difficult. And I just have such admiration for it. It's But with that said, I hear that you're writing a novel.
I'm writing a novel. And I have to say, it's exciting. There's something really gratifying about rolling out of bed and kind of, you know, staggering over to the computer every morning and waking up with the same set of characters in the same world every day and just kind of diving in. I love it. And what is interesting is that I do feel like working on this novel, I'm basically learning how to write all over again. You know, obviously, you know, certain things like dialogue or scene, all of that, like I feel more comfortable now that I've written the book, but just figuring out the overall structure of a novel is really difficult, and it's been incredibly exciting, but also really humbling to realize that, you know, that I have so much to learn, and that there, that, you know, that it's just not easy. Although it's really been a joy lately, just kind of being with a certain set of characters.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I heard that when you were writing the short stories and you'd get stuck, you would cheat on one story with another story. And I don't know if the novel gives you that latitude, or if you still keep writing stories while you're working on the novel.
It doesn't. I wish I did, because that was the best way for me to work, because it didn't allow me to take days off, because there was always something that was kind of beckoning for me to write. You know, I mean, I feel like there are so many other things that take my time, whether it's, you know, book reviews, or, you know, or I sometimes write essays or things like that. And that is great, because I'm still using my brain in a slightly similar way, and I'm thinking about books. But mostly what I've been doing is just allowing myself to write whatever scene feels the most urgent and exciting every day. And I'm just going to write these scenes and then figure out how they all kind of come together once they're done. And that's the way that I've been able to think about the novel. Like the idea of starting at the very beginning and just moving forward feels impossible, because I'm still trying to understand the psychology of my characters, and I'm still trying to really understand their different voices. And so I'm just kind of allowing myself to write in chunks right now. And that's, so it's basically the same thing that I've done, just sticking with the same world.
I gotcha. And I really like this idea of starting with character. You said all of these stories in this collection had started with character, and starting with that voice and that being so central, instead of starting with some plot action or, you know, something has to happen. I really like that it's driven by the people that are driving the boat, and they'll kind of tell you what's going to happen. I think that's a great approach.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I will say that there have been a few stories where I did start with the concept, or I started with the plot, and those are all the stories that ended up dying on the vine and now live in the embarrassing drawer on my desk. And I think it is because then the writing feels a bit mechanical to me, and it kind of feels like I'm moving chess pieces around on a board rather than really having the characters just speak for themselves. And I think for the collection, and I think maybe just for the way that I like to write in general, I like work that feels really confessional, and it feels like, okay, and it has that urgency of here are the things that this person really needs to tell us. And I love that intimacy between a narrator and a reader, and that just seems to work the best when these are completely character-driven and voice-driven pieces.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree. Is there any advice, writing advice, publishing advice, any advice you can leave that we haven't talked about so far?
Oh, sure. I mean, I would say the main thing that I tell my students, and that I really, really deeply believe, is just don't rush to, like, there's a difference between writing a book and being a writer. And I think that there's this feeling of, like, wanting to get one's work out into the world, you know, because writing is so lonely and because it can feel so validating and exciting to have readers. But I really feel like there's only one chance to have a first book and one chance to share one's work with, you know, with readers they don't know. And so I think there's something about just really, really being patient and taking one's time, and also just understanding, like, what a humbling process it is, and that it's better to really wait on something and feel, you know, I mean, you know, the thing is once a book comes out, like, or once you send a book out, like, you know, there's no guarantee that anyone's going to want to publish it. And when it does come out, there's no guarantee that anyone's going to want to read it. And even if they do, there's no guarantee that reviewers will like it. Like, all of that stuff is, like, completely out of my control and every other writer's control. And I feel like the one thing that we can control are the words on the page and the people that we're writing about. So I would just say, I mean, my advice is just hold on to those stories and make sure that you're really, really done with them before you put them out in the world.
I think that's great advice, because there are so many people that are just itchy. They're just itchy to get their stuff out. And I think there's a lot of regret after that. You know, once it's out there, and ain't no taking it back.
That's so true.
I know one of these was published in one story. Did you publish these along the way in other journals, or did you wait until the collection was gelled together?
I think I published half of them in journals, and then I had, you know, I can't remember who, but someone had given me the advice to, you know, to basically publish half of them and then hold on to the other ones, you know, for when you're sending the book out, because sometimes the publisher or the agent likes to try to place a couple right before, or likes to try to place a couple before the book comes out, just as, you know, a way for more people to be familiar with the work. So that was what I did. And the one story publication, that was such an amazing experience. Hannah Tinty is one of the best editors, and she helped me. That was a story, you know, when you were asking about, like, like, how intimate and how kind of scary can a piece get?
Yeah.
I thought that I had gotten about as intimate and as scary as I could. And then I did a round of edits with her and Tanya Ray, another editor at One Story, and they just, like, peeled back about three more layers of that story, and it was like intense and amazing to get to work on that revision with them.
Yeah, they're amazing. They are. They're an incredible team. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, we are out of time, but you remain my hero. Heroine.
Oh, thank you.
Can't wait for the novel and to have you back on. And I really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks so much, Molly.
Oh, thank you so much. This was a great time. I really appreciate it.
Me too. Okay. That was Molly Antipole. The book is The Un-Americans. It has been out. It's still out. Still recommend it. It is wonderful. We're going to take a very short break. Brad Watson is going to be on with me in the second half. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are on Twitter at KUCI FM. We are on Instagram at KUCI FM. This interview will join the others up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, that has all kinds of information on the radio show. And you can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Brad Watson is the author of two collections of stories, the novel The Heaven of Mercury, which was a finalist for the 2002 National Book Award, and now his latest, Miss Jane. His fiction has been published in The New Yorker, Granta, Electric Literature, The Idaho Review, among other publications. He teaches in the University of Wyoming, Laramie. Miss Jane is the subject of our chat this morning. It's published by Norton, and it's my huge pleasure to have him on. Brad, hi.
Hi, Marie. Thank you.
Thank you for doing this. I love this book for so many reasons. And before we start talking about it, I'm just going to give you a chance to introduce it and kind of take us into Miss Jane's world and what inspired it and tell us a little bit about her.
Well, Jane is Jane Chisholm. She's a girl, 1915, in Mississippi on a small farm north of the town of Mercury, which is based on my hometown, Meridian. And it's a small cattle farm. She's born with a severe and very rare birth defect that they don't even recognize when she's born. But it's doctor has to try to figure out what it is by corresponding with friends over time at the Johns Hopkins University Hospital. And the book is about Jane coming into herself as a girl and then a woman, and learning more about her condition, learning how to handle it. She's left with lifelong incontinence and the inability to have romantic love, to have sex, to have children. The anomaly that she is born with prevents that. There's no surgical treatment for it available. In fact, there's no treatment for this condition until around 1982. And it's a book in my mind, and I think in the readers who appreciated it, it's mine, about a triumph over what was basically a person's oppression by her being oppressed by her own body, the limitations of her own body, and of course the social stigma that comes along with that in the book. So she's an exceptionally strong character who is determined to lead as normal a life as she can, even though many would have considered her a freak. And she does this with the help of the doctor who delivers her, who becomes a lifelong friend and is sort of an extraordinary person, kind of a philosopher, if you will, a country doctor who goes around and loves his people. And as best they can, her mother, her father, who is afflicted with depression and alcoholism, but loves his daughter very much. And her mother, who has lost three children, and is so beat down and bitter by that, it makes it difficult for her to express love, even though there are ways in which we find out that she definitely feels it toward this daughter. She's mostly afraid of losing this daughter and afraid of her daughter's affliction. And Jane's older sister, Grace, who is a really, really wild, sort of a little bit of a wild cat, and an independent soul who mostly wants to get away and eventually does, but tries to help her sister also and does in her own way. But it's really about James finding a way to be a whole person, live a full life, and find her measure of contentment in spite of all the odds against her. And it was inspired by my great aunt, who was actually born in 1888 with a condition that left her similarly unable to have a romantic life, and also incontinent her entire life. But beyond that, no one knew anything, no one knew any details. She was, they just didn't talk about it in those days. I had my one sighting of her was when I was around 7 years old, and she came to our Sunday gathering at my grandmother's house, my grandmother's farm up in the country in that area. And she was just this very frail, older woman, dressed in Sunday black, being helped across the yard, and said, "Who's that?" "Well, that's Aunt Jane. She's Granbury Spurgeon's sister, and something's wrong with her." "And what?" "Well, we don't know." Later in life, in my 20s, I saw a photograph of an attractive young woman looking over her shoulder at the photographer in what seemed like a flirtatious manner, and I asked my mom who it was, and she told me it was Aunt Jane, which I was surprised, of course, knowing by then that she had never married. Assumed she'd never had a boyfriend, incontinent her entire life, never had children, lived alone. And then my mom said, "No, well, she was actually really popular with the boys. She used to go to dances up in the community." And thereby, the mystery around my great aunt was very much deepened at that point, because I said, "It looks like, you know, she's flirting with whoever took the picture." And mom said, "Maybe she was." And, later, late in life, she told my mother's sister that when she asked her what was going on with her body, she just said, made the cryptic comment, "I only have one." And so we assume she meant one opening for elimination of waste, and that was it. And so I began my urological detective work as best I could to come up with a condition that might possibly have been my aunt's, but would need to certainly be, you know, identified as what the character in my book is having to deal with. Once I settled on that, I was able to start trying to imagine my life. It ended up being not a book, you know, about my great aunt, because we really didn't know anything. And so the character was actually much more of, you know, entirely fictionalized than I thought she might be when I started. I thought I might have more raw material to work with, and then I didn't. So it became a work of the imagination to a great, even greater degree than I expected.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such an enormous act of empathy, because I talk to a lot of writers about writing from the opposite gender or writing from a different time period, and what a big act of empathy that is. But to take something that's so essential about being a woman at a time when women were really very valued for, you know, sex and marriage and reproduction and, you know, having children, that was a large role in the life of a woman in that time period. And so,
especially,
you know,
a farm woman.
Yeah. And a farm woman. Right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's such a lovely act of empathy, and you know, your treatment of her or her life in the book is so incredibly rich and so incredibly deeply felt and visceral that, I don't know how you found her voice or how you found that, road into her that was, so incredibly tender. I don't know if you can talk about sort of making that mental leap from who you are to who she is.
Well, I did have a hard time. I think I had a harder time finding that way in with her than I have ever had with another character. And the time just frightened me. I thought, maybe this is not my book. But I had ways in eventually, as it, you know, I was persistent, and as novelists have to be. And I had these photographs of my great aunt that were just... more and more, as I, you know, as I worked along, the more often I looked at them, the more I was moved by them, and seemed to be then try to imagine what, you know, she felt like in her world. That was sort of early on, and then I also had my mom's stories of growing up on the farm at a later date that I could use for to help imagine the place, which was also, of course, really important. And I began to move Jane out into the natural world, and it seemed a natural thing for someone who was different and isolated in so many ways to go out into the woods and to feel a kind of communion with nature, because she is a natural being. Even though people treat her as someone who's different, she's simply another manifestation, you know, of humanity, in the same way that all the flowers and trees and mushrooms and everything else are different and, you know, quote, strange in their own way. It helps her, I think, to feel like someone who belongs in the world, a natural part of it. I was still having trouble, though, and really it was only when I sort of backed off a bit and said, well, I'm going to write more into the supporting characters, the doctor I had already been writing a lot into, but also the father, trying to get to know him, who he was, and write about him, his what he was struggling with in this situation. And the mother, of course, was obviously struggling in the situation, and Grace, in a bit of a dark comedy way, was also kind of struggling with it. And it was really, I gained better access after I backed off and said, I'm going to look at Jane through the lens of these other characters, because they are obviously, they care about her, and she is the center of their world, as they want to make her life something that is not a life of oppression and denial, but they struggle, you know, to figure out how to do this. Doctor is the one who is best at helping her, but they all think about it. They all yearn to, in their own way, and really the voice, the narrative voice, began to come alive better in these characters before I could make it happen in Jane, because I think I was trying too hard to reimagine my aunt, and before I realized that no, you have to. This person's got to come out of the, you know, the whole cloth of the situation. She can't come out of your aunt, because your aunt is a mystery and always will be.
Yeah.
Which is why I dedicate the book in part to the lost memory of my great aunt Mary Alice Jane Clay. But yeah, they were an important conduit. After I wrote some more of them, I went back to Jane, and I felt I had more access to her interior voice. You know, after I looked at her through the eyes of those who loved her. Another side anecdote, Maria said, that when I saw this picture of my aunt as a young woman, an attractive young woman, I said, I want to find her grave. My mom sent me to the cemetery in the right place, and I came back and I said, I didn't find it. There's a Mary Ellis Clay there with the, seems like the right dates of birth and death, but no Jane. My mom said, oh yeah, that was Aunt Jane. I said, really, why did she go by Jane when her name was Mary Ellis? And she said, I don't know. We just always called her Jane. So there were all these little mysteries, you know, that made me think this person is very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Not only, you know, those sorts of things, but also anyone who remembered her said they always remembered Aunt Jane as being very upbeat, cheerful, never complaining, never allowing herself to be an object of pity, and always standing on her own and finding her way. And she loved children. So these little things, you know, sometimes you don't have very many bits to go on, but sometimes it's enough to begin to try to imagine a life in a piece of fiction.
And it's so rich, because you would, you know, on first blush, you would think that she would desexualize herself, that she would, you know, take all of these impulses and emotions underground. And, you know, with that, you would expect bitterness, or you would expect depression, or you would expect all kinds of things that she was not. She was the antithesis of that, which I think makes such rich fiction, because it, you know, goes against the unexpected, that everything around her was sort of hypersexualized, and her world was sensual. Maybe not hypersexualized, but hypersensualized. Everything was so sensual, and the world around her, she found such grace and beauty and, you know, richness in, and it was just so lovely.
Yeah, I think when I was able to write that, there was a scene in which, you know, the doctor, a little bit tipsy, brings by a bucket of iced oysters and beer, and tastes this. You know, they don't know what it is. They haven't traveled to the Gulf Coast and gone into the fancy restaurants, and she takes this oyster, and it's an amazing experience, and tries to share. share it with someone, turns her down. And, but then she goes out into the field after eating another one of them, this strange thing. And there's a passage about all the ways in which all these other things in the natural world were sexual for Jane, in her own way. And I realized, well, I think after I wrote that paragraph, which was the end of the chapter, I felt as if I was sort of in there at that point.
Yeah, right, right. And I really like your observation about getting to her through other characters, because I was going to say, a lot of times we talk about, you know, how you get inside a character's head, how you mind the character. And my impression of this book was that it was really through the relationships that made this work so well, and particularly, as you said, her relationship with Dr. Thompson, that was such a unique, interesting, intimate, you know, both, I don't know, I mean, they just had the greatest relationship, and I was wondering if you could just talk about them together and how you knew that you'd hit the right note with them, and, you know, their conversations are so wonderful, and his afflictions are great. You know, what he's dealing with in his life are so resonant with her. And tell me a little bit about where that relationship started and how you knew you were running on all cylinders with it.
Well, in the very early drafts, he was a different sort of person. He was not, more like a sort of hefty, he was a bit of a caricature of the country doctor. And I realized that was going off in some direction that wasn't going to merge in a good way with the book. It wasn't really going to become, you know, something that supported and helped to drive the book. And so I started to rethink him as someone who was a more attractive character, a character with whom it would be easier for, you know, me and the reader to empathize and understand, and someone who would be more attractive, you know, to the reader and to everybody. He's a kind soul. He has a kind of rugged handsomeness. He is a bit of a romantic, even though he's also kind of a hardcore philosopher. And he just began to emerge that way. I began to realize how important he needed to be in the story to Jane, because everyone else around her, close to her and her family, they are crippled in their own way by their problems. And he is someone who, although he loses his wife to the flu epidemic, and did not have a perfect union with her anyway. There was depression on her part, and he struggled with that. In a way, Jane replaces the role in his life that he wished his wife would had been able to play, and that is of someone he could give his love to, and someone who would love him back as close to unconditionally as is possible between two human beings. And Jane is willing to give that. There is a kind of a love affair going on between them, even though 39 years separate them, and it is not at all physical. I don't even know if you call it platonic in the sense that we understand that or think about that. But very much there is love between these two people that helps to sustain them. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like that's at the center of this story. So that when he dies, being 40 years older than her, his legacy is not simply the land he leaves her, the house he leaves her. His presence is still there in her life, the awareness of who he was. He is really, I think, a model in a sense, and certainly an inspiration to her. That helps, you know, in helping her to, at that point, know how to be alone, because he was a man who felt his loneliness greatly and lived with it. Jane was as much a gift to him as he was to her. I think she knew that.
Yeah, right. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. We're drawing down on our time, but I wonder if there, over the course of the two novels, the two short story collections, if there is some advice that you give out to writers that you've gleaned along the way.
Well, I think I told someone else recently that my advice is to trust yourself, you know, to read good stuff, read good novels, read good stories, things that make you want to write, things that make you want to emulate them or be as good as them. and then to just write and not be discouraged by the fact that it's probably going to be a lot harder than you thought, and it's going to take longer to get as good at it as you want to be, as you thought or hoped. And the other part of it is be very be careful what sort of advice you listen to. even your writers, your teachers, you know, everybody. Most writers have strong opinions in one way or another about how to do this or how to do that. And I always say, well, you know, be skeptical about that. You know, be respectful if they're giving it respectfully. But yeah, don't, you know, it's going to be you finally who figures out how it works for you. And I think that's most important.
Yeah, and that really.
I just got my writing. You know, I'll just, if you got them, I don't know if you're out of time or not, but I'll.
No, go ahead.
I came up with what I thought was a nice analogy for my writing process the other day when I was talking to someone. Which is, I wander into the swamp, and I get lost, and I'm continually falling into mud bog holes and having a hard time getting out. And I get out and clean up, and I fall into another one, and I stay lost, and I wander around like this in the swamp, you know, without being able to see any sort of vista for a long time until I finally come out the other side with dinner years later. That's it.
I love that. Spoken like a true Mississippi writer of the swamp. I love that. We don't have enough swamps around here in Irvine. Yeah. I love it. And to your point about it's going to take longer to get good than you think, I think Ira Glass made that point about you go into writing because you have good taste and you're a big reader usually. And so you know what good writing is and you have this great taste. And getting your own stuff to match your standards and your taste in writing is a really long process. And so, yeah, it takes a lot of patience.
You have to withstand a lot of, not only, I mean, everyone hears and knows that you're going to experience a lot of rejection, but what's missing in that old maxim is that a lot of the rejection comes from yourself once you become, get good enough to be honest with yourself and you know whether it's good or not. Huh. So there's some frustration that you're going to deal with, you know, on more than one level.
Yeah.
But the payoff is pretty damn great when you make it work.
This is pretty damn great. Yeah. And you know, I mean, aside from publication success, just having produced this, even if it never made it out into the world, you have to look at this book and say, that was pretty damn great. I mean, it's, you know, there's satisfaction in the process itself, aside from the whole publication game of getting it out there. But,
you have to, that has to, you know, you can't keep going if you're not doing it for that. I mean, it would be wonderful to have a bestseller, but you're not going to finish the book if you're not writing it for those reasons that you talked about.
Yeah, exactly. Brad Watson, this was a huge, huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you, Marie. You're welcome.
That was Brad Watson. The book is Miss Jane. It is published by Norton. It's such a gorgeous novel. Highly recommend it. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day and stay tuned for more awesome music on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.